Hello, and welcome back to Bench to Bedside. I'm your host, Dr. Susan Firth, Executive Vice President and Chief Scientific Officer of the Research Institute. In this four-part series of our podcast, we're meeting the leaders of our frontier programs, which are launching in 2023. By investing in frontier programs, CHOP brings the best minds to address the most challenging conditions. Through this initiative, CHOP is once again redefining what's possible. My guest today is physician scientist Lindsay George, who is co-leading the Novel Therapeutics for Bleeding Disorders Frontier Program, also known as the NOT Bleeding Program. Welcome, Dr. George. We're so glad to have you here, and we're really excited about the Novel Therapeutics for Bleeding Disorders Frontier Program. It's a great title, the NOT Bleeding Program, and it's led by you and others, really a team of world experts who together, if you add it all up, it seems like you've had more than two decades of clinical experience in gene therapy for hemophilia and in other related bleeding disorders. From your vantage point and also the people who trained you, how has the landscape of bleeding disorder research changed over the last few years?
I think it's a really remarkable time to be in this field. What I think is most exciting is you can kind of see the straight path from innovation to helping patients. Clearly, there's some zigzags along the way, but you can really start to see the path forward. I think what I would say is specific to hemophilia, there's some advantages to studying this disease, right? There's readily available biomarkers. You can do a blood draw and measure the deficient factor function, and then we have a very clear idea what that means for phenotype. So that combined with a reasonably good molecular understanding of the disease has really allowed a lot of innovation, I think, in the field. And then concurrently, there's all these sort of novel technologies that are being developed that can relatively easily be applied to hemophilia, or easily being a bit of a misnomer. You know, we're approaching things like protein engineering, antisense oligonucleotides, siRNA, sort of novel monoclonal antibodies, and then, of course, gene-based therapies. You know, there's this rapid expansion of novel approaches to bleeding disorders.
So for people listening, when you talk about protein reengineering, what do you mean?
So if you understand what causes the disease, how the function of the protein, then you can potentially rationally exploit the protein to have it work better. And we've seen that a couple different scenarios. So we're seeing that in sort of novel factor-based therapies for hemophilia. We've seen nature has actually given us a novel improved function factor 9 that's been universally adapted to hemophilia B gene therapy efforts. That's factor 9 PADWA, originally described here at CHOP. So I think these are just some of the examples. And then there's ongoing work in my lab. We sort of aim to understand the function of the factor 8 protein, potentially rationally exploit this for novel therapeutics for hemophilia A.
And you also mentioned siRNA. Can you tell listeners what that is?
Sure. So essentially the concept here is if you can silence the transcription translation of a protein of interest, then this could be a therapeutic option. So the approach that's being taken, if bleeding disorders are a disorder of procoagulation, one of the thoughts is to combat your natural anticoagulants. So you basically downregulate your natural anticoagulants to improve, you know, to allow a little bit more space for your procoagulant proteins to work.
Sounds great. And it sounds like there's many, many things on the horizon. Can you give us a sense, like, how fast is this moving? Like,
you know, it's a good question. I think one of the things when people look at sort of the evolution of hemophilia care, if you look over a century, it used to be that hemophilia patients die when they were average age of around 10. And now, thankfully, people can expect to have a normal life expectancy with hemophilia. So even over that arc, there's a dramatic change. And then I would say in the past 10 years, a remarkable improvement. So advances in bioengineering of proteins and then the advent of the molecular therapies. And I'm a bit biased here, most notably gene therapies. And so some of these things are starting to become a reality for patients. So, you know, we push the boundaries and hopes for these patients, you know, further and further towards a life that is less encumbered by their underlying disease pathology.
Because now, even though they're surviving, they need therapies very regularly, right?
Exactly. So even though patients can expect to have a normal life expectancy, many of their daily activities are planned around recurrent therapies that they need in order to hopefully avoid potentially life-altering bleeding events.
So you've been doing this work for quite some time, and so have many of the people you're working with. What excites you about being designated as a frontier program? What will this let you do?
The overarching goal when we initially thought about this was that on this campus, there's this remarkable expertise in hemostasis and in gene therapy as it relates to the basic translational and clinical science. And the genesis of the Frontiers Program was to bring those groups together, to create a sort of formal bridge, if you will, and to really to bring this together to meet the need of patients. As we were just talking about, there's all these novel therapeutics, and what we felt like was as they transitioned to the clinic, we could leverage the existing expertise here to create individualized treatment plans, to potentially learn, have a greater depth of knowledge of disease pathology, and ideally create novel therapeutic options for patients.
That's really exciting. Can you tell us how research is helping you develop new, more effective treatments and novel therapies that could improve the standard of care?
There are essentially three basic translational science projects that are part of our Frontiers program. One of which is led by Ben Samuelson-Jones, who aims to repurpose an existing bispecific monoclonal antibody that's currently in use for the majority of hemophilia A patients. He's marrying this with expertise in biochemistry of factor 9 protein. And actually what he rationalizes is that specific mutations may lend itself to this same therapy that we use for hemophilia A. He's done some work to sort of show proof of concept, and then the hope is to move this into the clinic. Rodney Kamiri is similarly a coagulation biochemist. He's developed an antibody that potentially could be broadly used for a variety of hemostatic disorders. This antibody targets one of your natural anticoagulants, protein C. So the concept here is if you downregulate protein C, then you take the brakes off of coagulation, if that makes sense. And then ongoing work is involved in protein engineering of factor 8. We're doing some preliminary studies to think about this in the context of gene editing, that hopefully this would be available for children one day. So most of our work is in vivo gene therapies, which at this point is primarily using adeno-associated viral vectors or AAV vectors. I think what's important to recognize is really much of this work originated at CHOP. Ongoing work for hemophilia B has been going on this campus for 2 to 2.5 decades, so a long time.
Do you have any anecdotes about things you've learned from patients or experiences that inspired you?
I think the one that sticks out to me the most was when early on doing some of this work, I had been a clinical PI of a factor 9 hemophilia B trial. These patients are missing the factor 9 protein. And it was the first really successful trial in hemophilia B gene therapy. Again, there had been this sort of remarkable history here at CHOP of developing this. And so we had seen, you know, a lot of success in the early aspects of the trial. And I always really liked the patient visits because they always kind of kept my perspective. I should note that we treat adults on these trials so far. At that point, we didn't have any proof of concept that this could help children. So the man had come in for his vector infusion in a wheelchair, actually, because he'd had, you know, several bleeding events back to back, despite, I think, very aggressive current standard of care. He came with his wife and his young son. And then I was seeing him a little over a year post follow-up. And in that time frame, I had my own children. So I think sometimes that gives everybody a wider perspective. And so I went to see him, and he showed me this picture of him in karate class with his son. You could see pride and happiness in his little boy's face and in his. And so it was really great to hear that story.
And that was something he could not have done previously.
Correct. He could not have done at all. And then concurrently, he had asked me a very good question about understanding the measure of how is this working. And there was sort of an outstanding scientific question of understanding how the variant protein, this factor 9 potable protein, worked. I didn't know the answer, nor did anybody else. But I think this actually speaks a little bit to CHOP being a special place. So I thought, well, I think we could answer this question. We enrolled him on a sort of local protocol, got a blood sample, and we were just trying to understand how the protein works. And as I walked to the lab, I ran to Valdo Ruda, who was the first to describe the factor 9 protein. I sort of explained the problem to him and got a little bit of advice. And I walked a little bit further, and I walked through Kathy High's old lab, and the vector had been developed in Kathy's lab. So I thought, oh, this is kind of funny walk of life, so to speak. And then I ran into a colleague, Ben Samuelson-Jones, who was studying the biochemistry of the protein. And I asked him this question. And between the two of us, we kind of devised a plan to work on this a little bit. And we did eventually come up with an answer together. So I think the full circle of the sort of bench to bedside. And I still think of that.
Sounds like it's one of the remarkable things about a place like this, like CHOP. That's really cool. That's great. So in addition to your clinical practice, you now direct the clinical in vivo gene therapy team at CHOP. So can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Sure. In vivo is essentially a catch-all for anything that's a therapeutic that you directly administer to the patient. So classically, gene therapy efforts are broken into in vivo and ex vivo therapy. So ex vivo, you're taking something and manipulating a cell outside the body. So this is the classic immunotherapies or cell therapies where you apherese cells from the patient, so transduce cells in culture and then re-administer them back to the patient. And then in vivo is direct administration to the patient. So the genesis of the in vivo gene therapy group is is that with the success of gene therapy efforts, it became clear that we were no longer having success just in mice, we were having success in people. And there was a sort of remarkable expansion of this work in clinical trial, and then actually increasingly, thankfully, improved therapies. And we thought, okay, well, we could probably help people with some of the expertise around gene therapy so that they could do their work. And it was really that simple of an idea. And I do remember that when we first started, I was worried that people may not be interested in help, but that was clearly wrong. So the group's busy. And I should just note that, as I mentioned, sort of the history at CHOP of doing this work, in addition to the PIs, it sort of created this critical mass of clinical research assistants and regulatory personnel that had helped some of that early work. And some of those people thankfully decided to stay and now work at CIGT. So they have, you know, major leadership and are important to the success of the work.
And what do you think clinical in vivo gene therapy will look like in 5 years or 10 years at a place like CHOP?
You know, there's only statistics, right, about the impact of genetic illness on children. Something like 75%, which seems a bit high to me, but somewhere around 50 to 75% of children admitted to tertiary centers like CHOP have some kind of genetic disorder. So theoretically, the potential to help people is very high. We might not get there in 5 years. But what we are seeing is remarkable expansion in clinical trial work and then concurrently success of licensed vectors. And so what I would see in the next 5 years is that we have a licensed vector for hemophilia B, one for hemophilia A. That's currently only licensed in adults. Hopefully some of that work will move to children. But we're seeing exciting work in Duchenne muscular dystrophy, several other neuromuscular disorders. So there's expected to be a licensed vector for Duchenne the next, theoretically, a couple of months. So we could see that. There's a ton of work going on in the metabolic disorders. So you could kind of see that there'll be pockets of the use of gene therapies, probably not in a large percentage of the patients, but major impacts, you know, on select patient populations right now for monogenetic disorders. And then I think beyond that, I'm optimistic that we could start to see growth of gene editing efforts and then conceivably treating sort of larger patient populations of genetic disorders.
The work you're doing is really exciting and transformational. Can you just talk a little bit, like, what inspired you to go to medical school and do science? I'm just curious.
So I didn't take a direct path to be a physician scientist, I would say. I kind of decided to go to medical school a bit late, but I had taken a biochemistry course, and actually the example that they had used for enzyme kinetics was coagulation. And then, as luck would have it, I had spent some time shadowing in a hemophilia clinic, which was great because I thought, okay, this is the only human physiology I know. So it seemed very rational to me, and I liked that. That was the early interest in hemostasis, and that kind of stuck. And then how I ended up interested in gene therapy was as a resident. An important context is that hemophilia care, standard of care, is recurrent protein administration. So I was taking care of a hemophilia patient that was admitted on the floor that needed protein-based therapy on a very regular basis. And at the time, that was controlled by the blood bank, and you had to write a slip. And it was, so I was drawing blood on this patient, and then I was back and forth at the blood bank to get factor products. And I thought, well, geez, maybe we should do gene therapy for hemophilia. This is a pretty straightforward disease. So in between that, I just did a PubMed search, and that's actually how I learned about work being done here at CHOP. So I thought, oh, this is very rational and interesting. And then that's actually why I wanted to come to CHOP. I came here for fellowship training.
Can you tell us, you know, what is it about CHOP and the Research Institute that's inspired you to stay and build your career here?
Well, what I do, I'm not sure there's anywhere else that would be a better fit, to be honest. So on the CHOP and Penn campus, I think it's arguably one of the strongest hemostasis groups. As I mentioned, you can walk down the hallway and get input from several people just as on a stroll, so to speak. And then I think combining that interest with gene therapy, of course, there's, you know, this tremendous knowledge base and expertise here. And then not just expertise, but just capability. You know, CHOP has a clinical grade vector core. I think that those two sort of really breadth and depth of expertise on campus, to me, is sort of why I wanted to be here for training and then why I was lucky enough to stick around for some time afterwards.
We've been very lucky that you've stayed here. What do you hope down the road will look like for the work that you're doing?
I hope that we see some advances in bringing some of these therapies down to children. Of course, the work in hemophilia gene therapy is really in adults at this point. And of course, I'm a pediatrician, so I want to help kids. And logically, it makes sense, right, to treat a child and not an adult.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's really great. Well, thank you very much. This has really been terrific. I really appreciate your taking the time.
Sure. Happy to be here. Thank you.
For more stories about the people of the Research Institute and the incredible work that they're doing, visit our blog, Cornerstone, at research.chop.edu/cornerstone-blog. Thanks very much.